Spirit, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Bank, a friendly bank in a friendly town. Here's your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio historian, collector, Ed Corcoran. And Ed, who's our guest tonight?
Well, tonight, Dick, we have a very familiar TV personality. She has her own talk show on television, but we were very much surprised that she had a great deal to do with radio. In fact, she wrote a lot of the very famous soap operas, so I thought she'd make an interesting guest, and she's with us tonight. Dick, meet Virginia Graham.
Virginia, it's great to have you here on the Golden Age of Radio.
Thank you. I mean, I knew I was going to be a member of the Golden Age Club, but I didn't know it was going to come this soon.
Well, I just never realized that you were so closely associated with radio, because when we met in, I guess it was about a month ago or so, I started talking about your career on the Zeke Matters
right.
television show, but it goes back a long way before that.
1936, I was married, and Lynn was born. She had just been born, and a friend of mine knew the head of WMCA Radio in New York, and they had a show called Grandstand and Bandstand, Wade Hoyt, Ken Strong, Mae Murray, it was fantastic. It was 2 hours, horse races, and I went on and wrote the first commercial. See, I was a journalism major. And my first commercial that was integrated by having a personality, I wasn't on the air, I was writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I got 35 a week for 2 hours a day. I got 75. No, I mean, I think they realized I was suffering. So I wrote 2 hours of commercials, 5 days a week, using the stars. Now, nobody had ever thought then, you know, of using the stars. Doing a commercial was always an announcer would butt in.
That's right.
Then Mae Murray decided to do an advice to the lovelorn. Well, delinquency went up about 100% in 1 year, you see, and I did the writing. So when she went off, they decided they'd put me on doing recipes. I think I should have been sponsored by a stove company, because I burnt more ovens in 1 year. I gave more ptomaine than bad fish. I was called Betty Baker, and I was a subsidiary of Betty Crocker, and I had to wrap something in Bisquick every day. Now, 365 days of wrapping, I was doing Venetian blinds and doorknobs. I mean, how many things can you wrap in Bisquick? So,
and this is on radio.
This is on radio, and I wondered, now, who the heck listens? Who the heck listens? So finally, I got into a taxi one day, and the driver said to me, "Where are you going, Miss Baker?" I said, "My God, other than Harry, this must be the only man that listens in all of New York." I says, "How did you know who I was? You know, stardom in my eyes." He says, "Will you come on right before the horse races?" So I never learned never to ask, ever. When someone says, "How are you?" I tell them.
So that's, you were writing for WMCA.
So that's 36. Was it 36? How many years ago was that?
Well,
38.
Mm-hmm.
I married 39.
Years ago,
yeah. I married 39 years, so it's 38 years ago.
Well, Virginia, I know you worked for WMCA in New York, but what happened between that time and the time you went to the soaps?
That was right from there I went to the soaps.
Oh.
And I washed that man right out of my hair when the war went. In 1939, I volunteered with Red Cross. I stopped writing because I lived in the country and I was raising my child, and Harry was ineligible for this or even the Boer War. He missed both of them. So I felt that it was my duty to volunteer in any way that I could to make up or to express my gratitude for the fact that my family was not involved. So I joined Red Cross, and I worked 10 hours a day, Dick, 5 days a week. I was our secret whip.
I guess so.
And that's when I gave up writing Stella Dallas and Backstage Wife. That was my original, again, vicariously.
I'm curious, but were you using the name Virginia Graham when you were doing your writing?
I was writing then under the name of Virginia Gotham. Can you believe it? I wanted something with my initial, because as a bride, everything was monogrammed, you know. So I wanted a G, and I figured I'd move from Chicago to New York. What's the name of New York?
Gotham City, right.
And it was this fortune teller at the little club in New York who said to me, "You're never going to make it with that name." And she changed it to Graham. I'd like to find her. Everything in life is named Graham, including crackers. Virginia Gotham, at least I would have had a hotel named after me, you know. But isn't that funny? She said, numerically, you're not going to have. And the second I changed my name, marvelous things happened.
Would give some credence, I guess, to it.
Add credence to the courage it gives you. You know what I mean? When an astrologist tells you you're going to have a good month, you make things happen. And, it's really an amazing thing how much the psychic can do for you, because you are your own regenerative energy.
That's right. That's so important.
My son-in-law just had very serious surgery, and he came out of it with flying colors. The doctor said he never saw anybody in his life. He wanted to be at a meeting, and hell could brim over. Hellfire, he was going. His recovery is on record, because the motivation was so great, thank God he was fine. But the motivation for any surgical recovery is not where the incision is, ever. It's in the heart and in the mind. And the doctor says, this is of record. We've never seen it. I said, but you never knew anybody that wanted to do what he wants to do as much.
Well, Virginia, you talked about Stella Dallas, and believe it or not, I have one. You know, it's a hard show to find, but I have an excerpt here, and why don't we play it and see whether you remember this particular one, okay?
And now for our sequel to Stella Dallas. In Washington, with her daughter Laurel and Laurel's husband Dick Grosvenor, Stella Dallas is falsely accused by Dick's mother, Mrs. Grosvenor, of stealing an Egyptian mummy. Stella, however, through Jeff Cantrell, an underworld acquaintance of Stella's old admirer, Ed Munn, discovers the real thief to be Rashid, the twin brother of her friend Sheikh Ahmed, whom Mrs. Grosvenor is sponsoring in society. And Stella upsets Rashid's scheme to get $15,000 from Mrs. Grosvenor. To save Ahmed's family honor and avoid embarrassment for Mrs. Grosvenor, Stella agrees to keep the matter a secret upon Rashid's promise that he will keep out of their way in the future. Now it's the next night in Lal's apartment, and Stella is having after-dinner coffee with Laurel and Dick.
Well, Stella, how does it feel to be back with Laurel and me in our apartment?
Oh, it's just swell, Dick.
Oh, Mommy, it makes me so happy that you're staying here with us instead of at that hotel. I never would have let you go there in the first place if it weren't... Well, it's...
I know, Lolly. You're thinking about the little misunderstanding you and I had coming down from New York on the train.
Well, yes, I was. But that's all cleared up. And now I'm never going to let you go again.
I still feel kind of guilty about taking that room away from Baby Jones' nurse.
Oh, you didn't take it away from her, Stella. It's your room, and it always has been.
Of course, Mommy. And anyway, I'd really rather have the nurse sleeping in the same room with Jones.
Oh, both of you are sure doing everything you can to make me feel welcome.
I guess you don't realize what an important person you are to everybody, Stella. Why, Mother's singing your praises from the housetop.
Why shouldn't she? After Mommy saved her from giving $15,000 to Rashid. I'm sure nobody but you, Mommy, could ever have discovered that Rashid was Ahmed's twin brother.
We all thought Rashid was Ahmed.
Yes, but you didn't know Ahmed had a twin brother, and I did. And if I hadn't remembered that Rashid's accomplice, Jeff Cantrell, was an acquaintance of Ed Munn's, I'd probably never have found out the truth.
Well, Rashid's out of the way now, and we'll probably never hear from this man Cantrell.
I don't think so either, Dick, although Ed Munn's scared that he might.
Oh, is he?
Yeah, but that's only because Cantrell has this bad check of Ed's and has been threatening Ed.
Oh, there's the front door buzzer. I wonder who in the world can be calling on us this evening.
I hope the maid tells whoever it is we're not in. I'd like the three of us to have just a quiet evening at home tonight.
Yeah.
Hey, Del!
Oh,
where are you?
It's Ed Munn.
Huh. He sounds pretty boisterous to me.
Shall we let him in?
Hey, Del! Come and tell this. Maybe it's okay for me to come in.
I better go out of Lolly. He'll never go away without seeing me.
So Jeff Cantrell is planning to go to Washington soon. How will his visit affect Stella and her loved ones? And what of Ed Munn's decision to settle down in Washington? Don't miss the new developments in our sequel to Stella Dallas on Monday.
Christmas green, Christmas green, keep your Christmas green.
You can count the difference at Christmas.
You're worth more with us.
There There's an old saying that time waits for no man and few women, so joining the 1975 Christmas Club at Cromwell Savings Bank now makes good sense, to say nothing of the good dollars that can accumulate in 50 weekly payments. And Cromwell Savings Bank crowns your money tree with an extra payment absolutely free, a big bonus from Cromwell Savings. At Cromwell Savings, you can count the difference because you are worth more.
Cromwell Savings Bank.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, where there's always plenty of free parking, located at Main and West Streets in Cromwell.
Our guest tonight on the Golden Age of Radio is television personality Virginia Graham. We're talking not about television, incidentally, but about Virginia's radio career.
Yes, Virginia. Well, how did you actually get started writing soaps, anyway?
Well, I meet everybody at parties. Mm-hmm. You know, they always say it's not who you know. You bet your life it is. I mean, if I had met Jackie or her sister, maybe I would be married to, oh, God forbid. But at any rate, of course it is. It's being at the right place and being the right people. Again, I was at a dinner party, and there was a girl there who was with Blackett Sample and Hummert, who at that time would buy, for instance, Louise Prouty wrote Stella Dallas. Mrs. Hummert bought it. The agency bought the rights to the book, and then they would assign ghostwriters. Mm-hmm. I was at a party with the woman who was in charge of hiring writers. So as you sit and talk, and I was telling her how I had covered the St. Valentine's Day Massacre as a cub reporter for the Tribune, I was telling her how I had had a play produced at the Kenneth Sawyer Goodman Theater when I was only 10 years old. I had written this play. And, you know, people invite me because I, you know, I tell stories. So she said, you know, we used enormous turnover of ghostwriters. If you're on an ego trip, forget it. But unless you create your own story, they have a whole series, Dick, which nobody ever knew about radio, of people that would write for the soaps.
And go from one show to another?
And go from one show to another. Well, I'd be talking to Mary Noble, a backstage wife of Larry, and then I'd go over to Helen Trent to find out why Gil Whitney didn't marry her. So, you know, and then Stella Dallas, who never had change of life, was on the air 40 years. The only flush she had was playing poker with Minnie Brady. And, you know, it was absolutely fascinating. And when someone was expecting, oh, that infant anticipating, the wife would find the husband knitting, and the rabbit test took anywhere from 2 to 3 years. The rabbit didn't even get a glint in his eye. You know, they always used to say you could go to Europe and come back, and nothing
would
happen.
Never miss anything, right?
But it was a marvelous technique, because radio, as you and I have discussed, and as I told you, is the whole value of a person. The whole communication of a person is in their voice. I used to wonder what Helen Trent looked like, or Our Gal Sunday, you know. And you had that joy of creating your own cast. You could create them to look the way you wanted them to look.
Now, was there a storyline?
Oh, yes. You submitted your storyline. See, there were just, you couldn't have rape. Mm-hmm. Unless you put a G in front of it, which became grape. See, that, you couldn't have discussed anything like that in those days, you know. The pill was phenomint. And, the idea of birth control was breath control. You know, there was just, you know, orange juice instead of. But there just never was anything as outspoken. And we would do a storyline, kidnappings, poor girl marries rich man loses poor girl. You know, can a girl from a little mining town be happy with Lord Henry Brinthip? You bet your life she can, if she can only get to meet him. But this was a storyline 6 weeks in advance. Your scripts mm-hmm. were in case you were in an automobile accident. And it was highly controlled by the morals of the agency. You see, the agency had a part to play. Today, it's complete network in everything.
Did you ever actually create a character for a soap, Virginia?
No. I never had the pleasure of creating.
No.
I would have had one that would have wiped out a few people.
There's a story that somebody tells. I think Jack Parr told the story about the new director who came in on a soap and didn't like the characters who were on the program, so he put them all on a bus. And had the bus
had a collision?
Over a cliff, and went over a cliff on a Friday afternoon.
That's fat. Oh, so they could be prepared for a whole new show on Monday.
Sure.
Well, listen, do you remember The Killing of Sister George, which was really a rather outspoken movie? Did you ever see it?
No, I didn't. Oh, I know it
yes,
was.
Yes, it was quite outspoken. It was a three-dramamine picture for me, but or phenobarbital. But this woman who is nurses in England are called sister. A nurse, his title is sister.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to kill her off. And I can tell now I just almost die when I'm listening to radio or watching anything, when I can tell they're getting a sickness. I know they should be out in the employment ranks, you know, looking for a new job. But no, I never had that. But it's a terrible blow to the performer.
Were you ever involved in the so-called giveaways. You remember the radio premiums that were offered from time to time?
Of course, but no, but we didn't write that.
Oh, you didn't?
Oh, no, that was controlled by the agency. We were given so many minutes. There was 12 minutes out of a half hour. I mean, 18 minutes actual speaking out of a half hour. And we would write it, we'd couch it in our own vocabulary, but we'd be given the facts and how many minutes was allowed. There was more leniency with time, you know.
Yeah. How long would it take you to write a 15-minute script?
It got to be very, very easy. I'm a prolific writer because I write, it was very hard for me to regulate my muscular dexterity to my mental dexterity. I think too fast. That's why I have to do all my writing into a tape recorder because I'm not agile enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I would start editing myself because my muscular ability was slower than the way I could think. Oh, I would say a good 15-minute program took about an hour and a half. That's when I went over. See, I would only go over it on kind of guilt, because very often I would find that the first thing I would write is the best thing.
Yeah.
But then you start to think, and then you say it out loud. Now, first you write it. See, the most marvelous thing about tape, which we didn't have then, is that you can hear what you're reading. And for me, I think that was why my autobiography was such a good seller, because it was like I was talking, and I was. My skill is as a talker. I was writing for a talking medium, radio.
Sure.
So then you'd write it, and in case your neighbors heard you talking, they'd call the police, so you'd knock on the door and say, I'm reading back, you know, so they wouldn't think you were crazy. Then I would read it out loud and play all the parts.
You'd have to play all the parts.
Oh, yes. I had Harry do it, but he'd lose his place. And we almost broke up our marriage, so I did. But I had readers come in. I had kids come in and read the other parts. That's how I learn plays.
Yeah.
I have a reader with me doing the other parts.
Well, a lot of people listen to Bob and Ray in New York, and they do a soap called Mary Backstage, Noble Wife, and many people think that they actually originated that show, but actually that's not the case, and I'd like to prove it here by playing one of the soaps from the Golden Age, and maybe after hearing it, they may get some idea where their idea came from.
Once again, we bring you Mary Noble, Backstage Wife, the story of a simple young Iowa girl married to Larry Noble, the famous matinee idol, dream sweetheart of a million other women. The story of the joys and sorrows of the wife of a famous star as she struggles to hold his love in the complicated atmosphere of backstage life. Mary and Larry met H.C. Chappell, owner of one of Chicago's largest department stores, when Larry went there to pose for some pictures in the sporting goods department. Mr. Chappell took a liking to the Nobles and invited them to his home for dinner. Before they left the store, they met Shotzi, Mr. Chappell's debutante daughter. Shotzi is young, reckless, and just out of school. She told Larry she would be looking forward to seeing him again. Today, we find Mary backstage in Larry's dressing room, humming to herself.
Just a minute. Oh, good afternoon, Dick. Did you want me?
Yes, Miss Noble. A young lady just gave me this note to give to you.
Hmm. Thank you, Dick.
She's waiting in the green room, Miss Noble, and she expects an answer.
Well, I don't know anyone here in Chicago. I wonder who it can be. Well, let me see. Oh.
What? Something wrong, Mrs. Noble?
Wrong? Oh, no, nothing wrong, Dick, only you made a mistake. This letter's from Mr. Noble.
Oh, gee, I'm sorry, Mrs. Noble. I thought the girl said Mrs.
She'll have to wait for her answer, Dick. Mr. Noble hasn't arrived yet, but I expect him any minute.
Okay, Mrs. Noble.
I can hardly believe that Larry would encourage that girl. Oh, perhaps it's just another crush. The kind women always seem to be having on Larry. Let Larry know. I wonder what he'll say when he reads this note.
Hello, Mary.
see you beat me in today.
Yes, Larry. Finished my shopping early and thought I might as well come over here.
Good idea. Got a kiss for me, honey?
I have a letter for you, Larry.
Hmm.
I opened it by mistake. Vic thought it was for me.
Well, there's no harm in that. What is it, Bill?
No. Perhaps you better read it. The lady's waiting in the green room for an answer.
No, sounds like high-pressure salesmanship. I'm in a hurry, dear. Will you read it to me?
If you wish, Larry. It says, Larry, dear, have tea with me after the matinee. I know a ducky place where we won't be disturbed. I'm waiting downstairs to see you.
Real fan letter.
I'm not sure that it's merely a fan letter, Larry.
Oh, it must be.
It's signed Shossie.
Shossie? I've never heard that name before. Oh, I know. Isn't that H.C. Chappell's daughter?
Yes, it is, Larry.
She's just a kid.
She seems old enough to be interested in you.
Well, she's still a baby as far as I'm concerned.
Well, regardless, she's still waiting in the green room for an answer to her note.
Oh, I haven't got time to see her, honey. I've barely got time to make up for the show. It's late. Say, hand me that jar of cream, will you?
It is, Larry.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Larry, we can't let this shopkeep sit downstairs indefinitely.
Certainly not. Go on down and talk to her.
I?
Sure. Tell her that Saturday's too busy a day for tea parties and we won't be able to accept her invitation.
She didn't invite we, Larry. She invited you.
It's all the same. You know that I don't accept single invitations. Too much in love with you.
I dislike meeting her again under these conditions, Larry. She'll probably be embarrassed.
Oh, nonsense, honey. Run along and pat her on the head.
Look. All right, Larry. I'll do my best. Dr. Chappell may be a child of Larry, but I could tell by the way she looked at him yesterday that she doesn't feel that way about it.
Oh, Mrs. Noble, that girl's still waiting.
Oh, what door leads to the green room, Dick? I'm not as familiar with the Chicago theater as I was with our old theater in New York.
This first door at the left, Mrs. Noble.
Oh, I see it, Dick. Thanks. Hello, Miss Chappell. Oh, why? Why, hello, Mrs. Noble. Won't you sit down? I wanted to speak to you about the note you sent to Larry.
What do you know about my message, Mrs. Noble?
Oh, I opened the letter by mistake. The stagehand who delivered it thought it was for me.
You opened my message to Larry Noble?
Yes, it was a mistake.
A mistake, huh? It's another word for the commoner term of snooping, isn't it, Mrs. Noble?
No, Miss Chappell, it's not. I never open Larry's mail.
Perhaps I should take that as a compliment. Evidently, you felt my letter would be interesting.
Please, don't be silly. I had no way of knowing who the letter was from.
Now, I'm supposed to believe that, of course. Mrs. Noble, I'm not in the habit of having personal notes I send censored.
Don't you think you're going a bit beyond the bounds of good taste to speak to me this way, Miss Chappell?
I don't care what I'm doing. You had no right to open that letter. And I'll get even with you for doing it, Mary Noble.
Will Shotzi prove a new menace to Mary's happiness? We know she's bitter towards Mary. What will be her next step?
Get growing, you can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
The person who saves regularly guarantees his own bright future. Cromwell Savings Bank offers 5 convenient savings plans for their customers, including a 4-year certificate of deposit with a $1,000 minimum. These 4-year certificates of deposit pay an annual rate of 7.5% with an effective yield of 7.90%. Visit Cromwell Savings Bank and plan now for your future.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, where starting November 27th, all deposits are insured up to $40,000.
Our guest tonight on the Golden Age of Radio is television personality Virginia Graham. We're talking about Virginia's career back in the 1930s as a soap opera writer.
Yeah, we've talked to a lot of people, and you know, a lot of personalities come to come known to our interviews. Remember the one we talked about? Did the Gangbusters Dick? What was his name? Phillips H. Lord. But
yeah.
The Hummets are another group that a lot of curiosity has been arisen about them. What were they really like, Virginia? You worked for them. Could you tell us a little bit about them?
You never worked for the Hummets. You met them once.
Oh.
And now I want to tell you something about Mrs. Hummert, Mrs. Frank Hummert. She was a brilliant woman. She would never meet a ghostwriter. Perhaps after you were working for quite a while, she'd peek in. She did not want, she was like an honest pathologist in a hospital. You know, a pathologist is never allowed to know what room the specimen came from, the biopsy. Man, yes, maybe, I think they may be given a racial statistic or perhaps even a sexual, it's a man or a woman. But a real pathologist will never know who the patient is or what they suspect. Mrs. Hummert did not want to see a face she didn't like or a face she liked or chic or unchic. She didn't want the physical contour or personality of the person to influence her in a bias toward their writing. So she knew totally nothing about the writer. Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
Except the script.
This That's
is strictly
really
on
mattered.
Strictly on not on face value. Strictly on what she read. If she liked it and saw proficiency, that was the writer. So that you never knew the Hummerts, I worked for a girl by the name of Mildred Fenton, whose sister, well, she was married to Gardner Cowles, and she went on, Fleur Fenton was her name, and Fleur Cowles, and now she's Fleur Mayer, and a great, oh, God, they're ambitious women. I know a woman who married one of the richest men in the world, apropos of nothing. This is a real Virginia Graham non sequitur, but it fascinates me. She wanted to marry this man. She paid an enormous amount to the airline booker at Kennedy, and whenever he was going to go from New York to Washington, the booker would call her, the hooker booker, and they'd call her, and she'd get a seat next to this man. Now, within 6 months, they were married, and he left a wife who was pregnant at the time and married this girl.
You didn't incorporate that into any of your stories, did you?
This was, my dear, this would be kid stuff now. But I thought to myself, can you imagine how does a wife or a woman married to a man, like any of the greats, how do they protect themselves against ambitious women? Because God spare the man who, you know, that's why it's better to have a husband who has moderate success. You live in a moderate community. The happiest years of our life were in Great Neck, where we had modest but beautiful homes, six children in the house next to us, six across my child, who was an only child, not because it was wanted, but I was lucky to have her, had all this communal living. And we were at the happiest in those years.
Yeah, I suppose you're absolutely right. You're a target once you,
you really
achieve
are.
A certain status.
You are to the most avaricious as well as vicious.
The Hummerts had a concept that was unusual in design, Virginia. The storyline would come to an end and another would begin.
Yeah, that's right. As opposed to what we're seeing on television today, for instance, where, if I may say so, when anybody insults a soap, whether it's radio or television, they are totally, totally ignorant. To insult it. It is the very best acting as it was on radio.
That's right.
These are fantastic actors who take you out of your own agony to see agonies that are greater. But radio, I wish that the soaps would come back on radio. First of all, a woman was able to walk around the house. Frankly, you still can listen to them. You don't have to watch them. Once you know the characters, you know who's speaking. And it's radio is the most marvelous companion for the lonely. It updates you on everything. It's such a fantastic concept of being able to communicate to the imagination as well as to the ear, where all the other communications just lay it out for you and say, here it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Take it or leave it.
That's right. You're able to create your own sets.
Yeah.
You also had the flexibility in writing for a Stella Dallas, let's say, that you don't have in television, and that you could place her anywhere in the world at any
fantastic.
Time with the most elaborate sets.
Without having to do a remote. And, of course, Stella Dallas now has she and Ma Perkins both have marvelous restaurants in Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
No, tell me about that.
I haven't been there, but I have friends who have said that they have these marvelous places. I don't know whether they include rooming houses, but they have restaurants. I know people are going to write into you, Dick, and ask you where they are if they are traveling through the Amish country, you know, through Bucks County, which is so gorgeous. But I suppose there must be a record restaurateurs, you know, that they could get from the AAA or some people that supply these things.
Who played Stella Dallas?
What, you know, I forget. Virginia Johnson, I think, was the first. There were two. I think Virginia Johnson was the one that was playing. Now, I may be wrong on name. You know, something has happened to me. Do you think it's age? I was trying to think of Walter Pigeon's name. I knew it was a bird. I knew it wasn't Jonathan Segal. I was going crazy. I did a telethon with Herschel Bernardi for Israel the day of after the Yom Kippur War, when I was going on for an hour and became so enmeshed in this because I was doing something for American Cancer the next day. I was doing a live show on AM in the morning from 7 to 9, and I never left, and we made $4.5 million in 4.5 hours, which was something that's never been done, just in New York City. And I'm with Herschel Bernardi. Someone said to me, what was the name of that man that co-emceed the telethon? If I had to go to the electric chair, I couldn't remember.
Isn't that awful? I know.
See, now in radio, everything was scripted. There wasn't one line of ad-lib, which was, there were no disclaimers. See, when you watch a television show today, this is not necessarily, this person does not necessarily represent the thinking of the network. When you spoke, pardon me, on radio, you spoke for the radio ownership. So you would live or die by the word, by the audio, as opposed to the video.
Did you ever listen to your scripts as they were being read on the air?
Oh, my dear. Why don't you ask me if I watch my reruns on television? I once told James Gardner I watch my triple reruns. I love them so and sit and applaud. And he would never look at himself. He fell on the floor. Of course, you have to be critical. I am a buff about any form of entertainment. I love every sport. I'm mad about sports. I guess I just have a love affair with life. Mm. I can find something good in almost everything. I really can. I'm not a Pollyanna. I just love being alive. So I love all the things that are part of being alive. Now, I'm in this community at this time of the year. Do you know how long it took me to get from East Long Meadows to where I am in East Windsor? It's ordinarily a 20-minute drive. It took me an hour and a half. I looked at this architect called God, this master of beauty called our maker, and thought, how can anybody deny you? When you look at these trees going out into the blaze of glory before total disrobing, before total extinction of life, they go out in this blaze of glory. The colors here, there's just nothing like it. But beyond that, Dick, the beginning of new life in the spring, to know that there is no one so cruel as to destroy beauty, it has a resting period. And then it comes to life again. And I wonder if maybe that isn't our story as well. I get my greatest religious hope and faith that I may have the rebirth of spring.
You know, it's a concept that we were talking about, Jonathan Livingston Segal, just a moment ago. It came into the conversation. That's the concept, really, of that book.
And also the concept that if you try hard enough, who could say that a seagull couldn't fly the way he could?
Right.
There's so much that we can do. And, I think that radio stimulated and does stimulate the imagination. That, I think if you were to capsulize why I would rather work on radio, has she aged? Hasn't she? Is she thinner? Is she fatter? Do you like her hair? I don't like that dress. What jewelry is she wearing? All of this is gone in radio. All they like about you is the sound of your voice. Are you sincere? Are you warm?
Well, speaking of the voice, did you ever do any acting at all in your career?
I did a reading, and I think I was the 13th that was reading that day, and the snores from the control room, from the people that had to listen, were louder than an alert in World War II. And everybody that day had accepted, you go to a dramatic coach who tells you, now, marvelous reading is from a play called Accent on Youth. I was the 14th, and I was the 14th that was reading Accent on Youth. I was so bad that I woke them up. The fellow woke up. He says, my God, what's that? They hated me for interrupting their sleep. No, it was very hard for me to be anything but Virginia. And now I have to say, you still haven't seen the play, Dick.
No, you're right.
I feel badly, because it's a marvelous play.
And I'm not going to get the opportunity, because we're running out of time.
Well, I know, but I'll be in Saugus. If you ever have the courage to drive 2 hours to see it, I'll be there for a whole month at the Chateau de Ville in Saugus.
Well,
I
just might do that. That would make good sense.
Well, I'm not going to, put any deposit in the bank on that. But I am an actress. And nobody could believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're now going back, darling, to 1938, when I did this fantastic reading. This was not a part of my life. I wanted to be a mother. I wanted to be a part of the community. I wanted to be myself. I had no desire. I found no exaltation in playing somebody else's role. I wanted to be my own writer. I wanted to write each daily chapter, and I have.
Well, as a change of pace, let's do maybe a little more humorous type of soap opera. And I think the funniest one was called Ethel and Albert, which starred Peg Lynch. And she was on our show at one time, and I'd like to do it again because she was such a great guest. So let's listen to Ethel and Albert.
The Private Lives of Ethel and Albert, starring Peg Lynch and Alan Bunce. It's evening in the Arbuckle household. The family has just come home from a ride, and we find Ethel and Susie in the living room.
Susie, now don't start dragging things out of your dollhouse. You've got to go to bed, honey.
No, I don't want to go to bed.
Oh, yes, well, you're going anyway. Did you happen to notice whether I put milk bottles out or not, dear?
I did. I happened to notice there was some
good.
On the back porch.
Oh, fine. Well, I thought I did right after dinner,
but...
I
fell over them.
Oh, I'm tired myself. Susie, now, what did Mother tell you about not getting your toys all over? You're going up to bed, dear.
No, I don't want to go to bed.
Honestly, I am getting so tired of trying to get her up to bed.
Yeah, well, now, Susie, look, honey, you've had a nice evening, and you're up later than usual, too. Susie, you went for a ride in the car. You stopped and visited Mr. and Mrs. Mitchell and a little girl. Now, honey, after having such a nice time, you better be a good girl. And...
I'm not sleepy.
Oh, Susie, it's 8:30. You must be sleepy.
No, I want
to go. Well, you know, when it's bedtime, Mommy and Daddy go to bed. You want us to go to bed and leave you down here?
Yes.
You do? All right. Come on, Mommy.
What are you going to do?
Well, we're going to go to bed and leave Susie down here.
Oh, Albert.
Is that what you want, honey? It's bedtime. We're going on up to bed. Don't you think maybe you better go to bed, too, huh?
We can't go to bed yet. It's only 8:30.
Now, just a minute.
We're
going to break her of this once and for all.
I'm getting so tired of begging her to go to bed every night.
Well, we're
going
to put a stop to it right now. Susie, you want to go upstairs now and go to bed like a good girl?
No, I won't play with the dollhouse.
Well, you'll have to stay down here all by yourself, honey. Susie, did you hear me?
Yes.
You'll be downstairs here all by yourself.
I want to stay up all night.
Well, all right, all right. Come on, Mommy, come on, let's go up.
Did you lock the back door?
Yeah, and the front door, too. Well, good night.
Night, Susie.
Good night. Say
night. Oh, Albert, we just can't go upstairs and leave her down.
Go on now, get up the stairs.
No, she is such a baby.
She has got to learn a few things. Go on, get up the stairs now. Go on.
We can't just leave her downstairs alone. Goodness knows what she'll get into.
She can't get into very much. She must be too exhausted anyhow. You know, she's got this stubborn streak. That's why she won't go to bed, you know.
Well.
I'm just going to teach her a lesson now, once and for all. Okay. Close the bedroom door.
Well, dear,
now,
I think...
Now, close it. Yeah. Now.
What do you suppose she'll do?
She'll probably fall asleep on the floor downstairs.
Well, how's that going to teach her a lesson then? Then she'll just want to always stay up until she falls asleep on the floor downstairs.
No, no, I meant later on, honey. She's going to go through a period of wondering what happened to us in a second or two down there.
What do you suppose she's doing?
Now, honey, just forget about her.
Well, I'm not going to forget about her. Make me... Oh.
There. Now, see what I tell you? Give me my bathrobe. Come on.
Oh, well, here... Maybe she's ready to come upstairs now, dear.
You stay right here.
Well...
Now, stay right here. Yes?
Where's Mommy?
Your mother has gone to bed. Since you didn't want to come up to bed, since you wanted to stay downstairs and play with your toys, please stay right there and play with your toys. But don't call us anymore, because we've gone to bed. Mommy's going to bed, so please don't yell anymore. We don't want to wake her up.
Daddy.
Yes?
What are you doing?
Me, I'm going to go to bed and go to sleep, too. We'll see you in the morning. You having a good time playing with your toys?
Yes.
Oh, that's fine. That's what you wanted, isn't it? You wanted to stay up all night and play with your toys, didn't you?
Yes.
All right. Have a good time. Don't bother us, please. We're going to sleep. Good night. Good night.
Night.
Well, you gotta hand it to her. You know, she's got spunk, that kid. She really has.
Little pathetic voice.
Now, she's all right so far.
She wouldn't admit, you know, that she wasn't having any fun playing down there.
Well, they're so little and helpless,
Albert.
Well,
they've got to be disciplined.
Well, sometimes I just think, oh, to heck with discipline. I just feel like giving her anything she wants and letting her have her own way.
Yeah,
I know,
but you can't do it.
No, I know.
Oh, golly, I've been talking so much about going to bed, I feel sleepy.
Mm-hmm.
Honey, now, don't look so worried, will you? She's all right.
Let's see if we can see downstairs and see what she's doing.
Well, you can't see much of the living room from the head of the stairs.
Well, let's just try, shall we?
Sure,
I just... Wait,
then, you... Now, quiet now.
Yeah. Honestly, sometimes I think we ought to pick on somebody our own size.
Yeah, well, now, don't worry. This will teach her to go to bed when it's bedtime. Stand back now. Don't let her see you.
No, I won't. Yeah.
You get down on the floor and look through the banisters.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Can you see her?
No, not right. There she is. She's looking out the window. Golly, she seems to act as though she had just time on her hands.
Oh, Albert, she's just lost. She doesn't know what to do with herself.
Maybe her toys are not as fascinating as they seemed to be a few minutes ago.
Oh, she's got her drawing book. She's going to draw pictures.
Yeah. All right, come on. Come on, let's get back in the bedroom.
Come on. Oh.
Come on. Well, let's just settle down now and see what happens, huh? Is there anything to read up here?
No.
Of course, I would forget to bring up a paper.
There isn't anything to read up here except Alice in Wonderland, which Mrs. Palmer gave Susie. Susie's too little yet to enjoy it.
Well, all right. By golly, I'm not. I'll read Alice in Wonderland. Hey, you want me to read to you?
No, dear. I don't want you to read.
Now, look, just relax, will you? We said we were going upstairs to bed, and we got to stick to our word. You know, she'll get tired sooner or later. Let me just wait.
Oh, dear.
I'll read to you.
Oh, no, dear, don't
read.
Sure,
Alice in Wonderland, chapter 1.
Oh, Albert, I don't like that.
Here we go. Alice was beginning to get very tired of sitting by her sister on the bank and having nothing to do.
You know, I do think like disciplining Susie. Children is much harder on the parents.
Now, listen to the story, will you?
Yes, I will.
You know, I'd forgotten this story. Alice sees the rabbit go by, you know, and hears him say to himself, oh, dear, I shall be too late, said the rabbit. You remember, honey? Repeat, you are old, Father William, said the caterpillar. Alice folded her hands and began. You are old, Father William, the young man said, and your hair has become very white, and yet you incessantly stand on your head. Do you think at your age it is right?
Oh, Albert, I can't stand it anymore.
I think I've been reading very well, very expressively.
Well, it isn't that. I'm just worried about Susie. It's nearly 9:30.
Well, honey, the last time we looked, she was just playing with the doll.
Well, she wasn't really playing. She just acted as though she didn't know what else to do.
Well, she wanted to stay downstairs.
Well, I know, but let's look out again. Come on.
All right, quiet now, then.
Yeah, all right.
She probably... Hey, look out, she's coming. She's coming up the stairs. Get into bed.
What?
I can't close the door. She'll hear it. Go on, get into bed.
Oh, we're all dressed.
Never mind that. Get into bed and pull the covers up. Come on, hurry up.
Honestly, what is she doing?
She's coming up the stairs looking completely worn out. Hurry up now. Now, don't make a sound. Cover up.
Honestly.
Mommy? Daddy? Mom?
Where is she?
She turned around and went into her own room.
She must know we wouldn't go to sleep with all the lights on.
Well, she wouldn't think of that. When she goes to bed, there's lights on in the house, you know.
Honestly.
Oh, it's there! Let off the shoes!
What is she doing?
Well, there's no light in her room. You know, I suppose she's bumping into the furniture.
Oh, honey.
She's not going to hurt herself now. There's plenty of light coming in there from the hall.
What do you suppose she has in mind?
Maybe she came up to get some more of her toys. You know, she's going to stay up all night. I suppose she has to have plenty to play with.
Do you think we're doing the right thing?
I do. I guess she's kind of put out the way we just left her.
Well, I hope this does teach her a lesson. I don't want to go through it again.
I think it was a very smart idea.
Well, I hope so.
Honey, Hallie liked the way she stood in the doorway and whimpered and then shut up when she didn't get any results, huh?
Yes, I know. What is she doing? Can you see in there?
She's getting into her bed.
Is she...
With her clothes on?
No, now she's got her shoes off.
Well, her dress unbuttons down the back. I suppose she couldn't manage to get it off.
My God, honey, she's in bed. She's pulled the covers up.
Oh, bless her heart.
Yeah, well, I told you.
Told me what?
I told you this would teach her a lesson.
That's what it's probably taught her, is that she can go to bed whenever she likes, since now she's discovered she can come upstairs and get into bed herself.
I don't think so. I bet she's put in a pretty lonesome evening, if you ask me.
Well, now get up and turn off the lights and go back downstairs.
And now, wait a minute. Don't make any noise. Wait till she gets asleep.
Oh, listen, that child is so tired. She dropped off the minute she hit that pillow. Come on.
Yeah. Well, I guess I know a thing or two once in a while, huh? You know, she is pretty smart, honey. She's got a lot of spunk, too, that
kid. Yes, you know, I really thought she'd start howling and just keep it up, you know.
She's pretty stubborn, but I'm kind of proud of her. You know, she didn't scream and yell at all. She just came up and went to bed, honey. She looks so tired.
I know, poor little thing.
Well, she's learned now that she can't stay up late and not get tired, see? She's learned a lesson. Honey, let's take a peek at her. Come on.
I want to make sure she's covered up all right.
Yeah.
Shh.
Yeah.
Tiptoe?
Yes, shh. She asleep?
Oh, yes, she's exhausted. Doesn't she look darling? It seems terrible to play tricks on her this way.
It wasn't a trick, it was discipline.
Yes, well, come on, let's get out of here. Close her door.
Yeah.
Good night.
You know, did she say good night?
Well, I...
Susie?
Oh, I think she just said it in her sleep.
Wait a minute.
Come on, get out.
Was she pretending to snore then, like me?
Oh, no, she wasn't. She was just mumbling in her sleep, I'm sure.
Oh, by golly, you know, you got to keep just one jump ahead of them all the time, don't you?
Yes, you certainly do.
Someday I think I'll write a book about my experiences in bringing up a daughter. Huh. And I'm going to call it Albert in Wonderland. What do you think?
Get growing. You can count the difference when you're growing.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Now the friendly folks at Cromwell Savings Bank are friendlier than ever. In their continuing effort to expand and improve their services, they recently completed a survey of their customers' banking needs. The result? A majority indicated a desire for Saturday morning banking facilities. So now, Cromwell Savings Bank is open Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 12 noon for full banking services. Bank with them on Saturdays for your banking convenience.
You grow more with us.
Cromwell Savings Bank of Cromwell.
Cromwell Savings Bank, member FDIC, open Monday through Wednesday 9 to 3, Thursdays 9 to 5, Fridays 9 to 7:30 p.m., and now Saturday mornings 9 to 12 noon.
Our guest tonight on the Golden Age of Radio is Virginia Graham.
Well, of course, obviously, you left radio somewhere along the line. Was it in the 30s?
When World War II was declared, I went into Red Cross as a volunteer
and
for almost 9 years. Then I was one of the founders of United Cerebral Palsy. And 14 of us were all volunteers, and we started this entire operation that you see today, the whole woman's division, by 14 mothers, none of whom had CP children, but who had friends that had them, and who realized we had to be foster parents to the parents. We had to be the voice crying for help for the parents who were so involved in trying to save their own lives and their children's lives. So that by that time, television came into being.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the longest track record of anybody that's ever been on.
Yeah, from about 1950?
1950.
We were talking about Zeke right. Manners, and that's where it started.
I was on with Dave Garraway in 49.
Out of Chicago?
No, out of New York. And he had me as his guest host when he took 2 weeks off. And I had never been on. I went on doing a guest spot for a beauty show that I was involved in. And they laughed so at me. He says, "My God," he says, "you're a natural for this business. Would you?" It was a week. He said, "Well, I'm going away for a week. Would you like to MC?" I said, "Certainly, you know, no one in their right mind. What do you mean, certainly? What do you know about it?" I was terrible, Dick. I was so terrible that I shuddered. My nerve was greater than my talent. But I learned from that week, from the comments I got from my best friends.
That's all that really counts. Unfortunately, there are so many people in our business who never learn.
Yeah, but look at a chance like that. If I had known and done my homework and hadn't had this kind of ego, the thought you could just walk in and be great. I'd ask someone a question, and before they had a chance to even get a look on, I was on to something else, you know. I was on an ego trip. I wanted everyone to know I was on.
Yeah, yeah. So many hosts make that mistake, unfortunately.
Of course, in defense of talkers. You're invited on because you're a talker.
That's right.
And then they kid you about talking too much. And you know, Jack Parr, who was my benefactor, if you didn't make it in the first 30 seconds, if you didn't come on like a bat out of a propulsion engine and say something clever in 30 seconds, you were gone. Then he would get someone else on and he'd drop you so that you'd come on too fast, too furious. Johnny Carson, Merv Griffin, if you aren't provocative, if you've gotten the role of being able to talk, they put you at your worst.
That's right.
They use you to make them look good. And there are... I would say that the only one who doesn't do that is Mike Douglas.
Yes, I would agree with you completely.
I think that the others may have more other things to offer, but the only person who really and truly doesn't use you as the buttress of their cleverness is Mike.
And, of course, that humaneness comes through, I think.
For instance, I'm going to be on with him. But I was on with Howard Cosell. Just listen to this. Don Meredith and Frank Gifford and Victor Borg. And me. This is something. And it was one of the most hilarious shows of my life. Now, this was the day that I didn't know whether the world was going to begin or come to an end because of family illness. I wasn't able to be there. I knew the operation was going to take the whole day. So I went on that show for therapy, so I shouldn't think. I wanted to, because I knew that the second I got off the air, the doctor would be able to tell me yay or nay, and thank God it was yay. But I did the best show I think I've ever done. Now, people say that television is an X-ray eye, that it shows you as you really are. That is not true. If you are an actress or an actor, you act on television just like you do on the stage. You couldn't have told that I had a thought in my mind, nor would I allow my radio audience to know. This part of deception is what I think we owe the people that listen to us who have problems that are far greater than ours.
You're so right. Virginia Graham, we're running out of time. Thank you so much for being with us on
again,
the Golden Age of Radio.
What a joy to be with you, Dick. Thank you so much.
And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC Radio and Cromwell Savings Bank. Technical supervision by Bob Sherrago. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bill Grasty and Dick Bertel.
The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camel, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
Rinse so white and rinse so bright.